and welcome to Pound the Rock, the Score's NBA podcast. I'm Joe Wolfond, and joining me for the final episode of the regular season is my co-host, Joseph Cacciaro. Talk to me, Cash.
We made it to the end of another regular season. We got, we got a lot to talk about today, not just awards and regular season ending stuff, but we got a gripping play-in race in both conferences. And I don't mean that in the sense of like play-in race of who's going to get in, you know, like there's not some 11 seed trying to steal a spot, but the play-in race in terms of who's going to avoid the play-in, which teams are going to end up falling into the play-in and have a more treacherous path to playoff glory. All that is still to play for. I'm excited to watch a couple nights of great ball Friday and Sunday, see how the chips fall.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm sure it's like this every year, but it does feel like there are an inordinate number of seeds up for grabs still as we head into this final weekend. But we only have the one playoff matchup locked in, which of course is Mavs-Clippers Part 3.
Mavs-Clippers Part 3, Luka's revenge.
Maybe.
Mavs-Clippers Part 3, will Kawhi Leonard play? And if will we find out why he's not playing?
Why don't we start there? Because that is one of the things that I wanted to talk about. Because there's a bunch of injury news, I guess, to sift through. But one of the big ones is Kawhi and this kind of mysterious absence due to, what, knee soreness or knee swelling? What have they called it specifically? Like, it's very unspecified.
Swelling, right? Inflammation, I think they've been saying.
Yeah, so obviously that's not what you want to hear. And he's missed how many games in a row now? Five? Or six, sorry, six games in a row. And it seems like that's probably it for him for the rest of the regular season. Like, they do technically still have home court to play for in that first round series against Dallas. But obviously the most important consideration for them is just going to be getting Kawhi to the playoffs in as close to 100% shape as possible. So I imagine that he's not going to play these last couple of games and we will just see him when the playoffs start, if at all. But who the hell knows, man? This whole thing has had a weird air of mystery about it. And, you know, I commend the Clippers for basically getting back on track without Kawhi these last few games. Like, they had that huge win against Denver. They had a massive comeback win against the Cavs. Then they had that absolute demolition of the Suns in a game that I think Harden didn't play that game either.
Yeah. No Kawhi, no Harden in Phoenix against the full-strength Suns.
So they've played well here down the stretch, but obviously if they want to get past the Mavs in the first round, they're going to need Kawhi back and playing like Kawhi. So that looms as a pretty big if as we're looking ahead here.
Yeah, massive if. For the playoffs, for the first round, for the fates of both the Clippers and Mavs, the biggest question probably, well, maybe not, because there's some other injuries we're going to talk about. I was going to say the biggest question going into the playoffs, the biggest Western Conference question going into the playoffs is, what the hell is going on with Kawhi? And the Clippers better hope that it's resolved by the weekend, by next weekend, because they can't afford to go through this again.
There's nothing to say about that except that, like, let's hope that he makes it back and we'll wait and see. But if we're just looking at the Clippers on the whole and like the way they've played over these last few games, I will say, just because I had kind of, I wouldn't say I scoffed at the idea, but like thought that the notion that they were relying on Westbrook to come back and save them didn't really speak well of the position that their team was in. And I just want to give him a shout out because he actually has come back and reinvigorated them in terms of like their identity, the pace and intensity that they're playing with. I feel like that actually has come to fruition in a way that I was maybe a little bit too dismissive of.
Yeah. In fairness to you, though, if I remember correctly, when we had that conversation a couple weeks ago, what you had said at the time was if 35-year-old Russell Westbrook is the thermometer for your team and is like the player that who you're relying on to instill your team identity, however you want to say it, that's kind of a problem. And I still think that's a valid statement. Like, Westbrook has come back and, if anything, just proven that he really is the guy who brings the identity, which is great for him. And, you know, yeah, the team looked better with him. But I still stand by your point that it is concerning.
I mean, it's not that you don't want to be relying on him to be like the emotional leader of your team. But I think we've seen in a lot of cases, especially in the playoffs in years past, even when Westbrook was in his prime, that can kind of cut both ways. So,
yeah.
Basically, emotional leader or not, like, it's Kawhi who needs to come back and be the on-court leader of this team if they want to have any hope of getting past a red-hot Dallas Mavericks team. But from there, let's move on to some other really unfortunate injury news. Giannis Antetokounmpo suffers a non-contact calf strain in that game against Boston that looked like it could have been a lot worse at the time. You can maybe breathe a sigh of relief that it wasn't an Achilles and that there is the possibility that he will make it back in time for the start of the playoffs. They've announced already that he's done for the rest of the regular season. And again, another team that with their best player down has actually kind of picked themselves up off the mat. And the first, I mean, you know, they were crushing Boston in that game with Giannis healthy, and then they just closed it out without him. But then a really impressive throttling of the Magic a night later has put them in position where basically they just need to win one of these last two games at OKC and then at Orlando to sew up the number two seed in the East. Now, neither of those are easy games, especially with no Giannis, but the Bucks have at least put themselves in position where they control their own destiny to get to number two. But again, like with Kawhi, none of that matters if he's not going to be able to get back or if he's going to be significantly compromised when he does get back. And it's just, I mean, I'm not going to say this yet, like I'm not burying the Bucks yet, but it would feel like a fitting capstone to what has been just a vexing and frankly pretty disappointing season in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I mean, I'd gotten to the point where my one-time preseason title pick, I wasn't even confident in them winning more than a round anymore, if that, with Giannis. So without him, they would obviously be fully cooked. But like two wins over the Celtics and Magic with Giannis playing 2.5 of 8 quarters, definitely other than this potentially crippling injury for the Bucks, other than that, performance-wise, a solid week. And I'm surprised you haven't mentioned the fact that longtime Pound the Rock listener Doc Rivers replaced Malik Beasley in the starting lineup with Patrick Beverley, which multiple listeners have reached out on social media to say Doc PTR listener confirmed. Two games, small sample. I've liked what I've seen both from Beverley and from the team and from that starting unit with him in there. Let's see how long it continues. But again, all of these moot points if Giannis isn't in the lineup because it kind of doesn't matter.
Yeah, and I mean, I think he hit all of his threes in that game against Orlando, which is not going to happen most of the time. But, and I still am not convinced that like starting Beverley is the long-term solution, but I like the idea of trying it. I mean, maybe it's a little late in the season to be trying it. Like you might have wanted to get a bigger sample of that before the playoffs started to see if that's the kind of thing that could work for you. And it feels maybe a little bit more desperate, and there's just like not a lot of runway to learn enough, I guess, especially now with Giannis out. Like how much can you learn? Like Beasley was back in the starting lineup for that game against Orlando because Giannis wasn't there. So I don't know if you've learned enough about that look or your team as a whole, you know, with Beasley coming off of the bench. He had started every single game this season before that move was made in the 78th game of the year. So, I'm still not convinced that that is like the solution for them given Beverly's offensive limitations, but how you weigh that against Beasley's defensive limitations, which I actually think in the second half of the season he's been better, not good, but better. I guess we'll have to see, but still a lot to play for Milwaukee in these last couple of games, and they're going to have to do it without a guy who, as we'll get into later, I think is going to be on both of our MVP ballots. So
I think it's funny that, you know, a week ago you could have said, man, if only the Bucks could have Malik Beasley's shooting and Patrick Beverley's more rounded, okay, or like defensive abilities. And then a week later, well, Patrick Beverley just took care of that himself. Doesn't miss from three. Is Patrick Beverley on D? There you go. There's your perfect blend of Malik Beasley and Patrick Beverley, which I'm sure will continue.
Beverley is like one of these guys who can convince you at times that he can just sort of will himself into being a slightly better player when the situation demands it.
I feel like that's his career. He has willed himself into being an NBA player when the situation demands it, and the situation being the last decade. Real quick, before we get, I know you're hosting today, and I'm sure you want to move us along to another big topic, but since we're on the topic of us being right, I did want to mention, because last week, you know, I talked about how that Knicks team that I thought was the number two, was the second best team in the East, went healthy, and I said it's a bummer without Rando now, because even though I still think they're good and believe in them to compete night to night, I just don't think they can hit that same ceiling. And at the time, you said you actually still thought, like, the way this team was constructed with Brunson, with if OG gets back, which he now is, with just the depth and some of the two-way play around them, that, like, with Hartenstein, the way he was playing, and Mitchell Robinson back, like, that they had the pieces to still maybe even win a round and still make a run in the East playoffs. And since we last recorded...
Yeah, I think I said if OG makes it back that they could very well make the conference finals.
Yeah. So, and since we recorded that episode last Thursday, I believe, the Knicks have gone 4-1 with road wins in Milwaukee and Boston. So just classic Pound the Rock over here. Wolfon, we don't miss.
Well, I mean, we have to actually see if they can translate that to the playoffs before I take a victory lap. But
I'll take one for you.
But I'll just say, like, the reason that I felt that way was because what I have seen from Jalen Brunson this season in terms of his ability to scale up that workload and the burden of creation for himself, for his teammates, with pretty much no drop-off in efficiency, made me feel confident that they could surround him with more complementary type pieces rather than a Randle who would be able to shoulder some of that burden, soak up some of those on-ball possessions. And honestly, if previous postseasons are any indication, taking some of those Brunson possessions and giving them to Randle instead wouldn't necessarily be something that benefited the Knicks offense as a whole. As much as I think at a certain point Brunson is going to need somebody who can take some of that burden off of his shoulders, I think that the team is still pretty well constructed and well built to make a deep playoff run because they are nasty defensively and they have a lot of guys who can at least shoot the ball and attack a closeout, make the next play. Hartenstein making plays in the middle of the floor. Like, he is a really good connector. And he can also hit that push shot right in the middle. When defenses load up on Brunson, having a guy like him as a release valve is really valuable. DiVincenzo bombing threes at ridiculous volume, hitting them at a very high rate. Him and Josh Hart, like, defending their asses off. And, like, you know, Hart, as always, just sort of a one-man fast break who can inject that team with some very necessary pace. Like, I don't think they're going to miss Randle all that much. I think he's a great player who is having a fantastic season. But to me, him being out doesn't actually diminish my optimism in what this team can be in the playoffs all that much. So if I turn out to be right about that, then I will take a victory lap. But there's a lot that has to happen before I can do that.
Matchups included.
Yeah, matchups included, and again, like we said, all of that is still very much TBD as we head into the final weekend of the season. Over in the West, Karl Anthony Towns is apparently coming back tonight for the Timberwolves, who, despite losing that game in Denver, because they basically have the tiebreaker locked up, they split the season series, but Minnesota has a better division record in that gauntlet of a Northwest division, which means that if they finish with identical records, and right now the Wolves are a game back, they can still get to the number one seed. So Cat coming back for these last two games, they're home to Atlanta tonight and then home to Phoenix on Sunday. Denver is in San Antonio and in Memphis. So I think if the Nuggets really want that number one seed, that they'll probably be able to get it. But still, there is a chance for the Wolves. And regardless of whether it winds up with them earning that number one seed, having a couple games with Cat back in the lineup before the playoffs start is going to be a good thing for them. So what do you make of all this, Cash?
I mean, I think I mentioned it a few weeks ago. I mentioned it when Cat went down, and I said it again last week or 2 weeks ago, that like in the level Anthony Edwards had gotten to, him or, you know, his type of player, superstar scorer, plus great defense led by defensive player of the year type player, Rudy Gobert, plus depth, good coach. Like, it's more than enough to have a great regular season and then some, maybe win a round. And we've seen that with them staying in the thick of the race for the top seed without him, the way they competed against Denver the other night. And hell, you can make an argument that the best course of action going forward in the future is taking that formula and using Karl Anthony Towns to bring in even more depth and turning him into multiple pieces and assets. But for right now, for the way this team is constructed right now, going into the playoffs next week, I don't think there's any argument that for this team to hit their ceiling, especially offensively, they want and need Karl Anthony Towns back. And so I think him getting back, not in the middle of a playoff round, not, you know, being cleared the day before the playoffs start, but having potentially a couple regular season games to get his legs back under him, to then have that week where the teams are playing the play-in and the Wolves won't be and they'll be practicing. I think it's just a really good development for the Wolves, who have remained scrappy, and more than scrappy, good without Cap, but getting him back for these last two games, I think is good timing, and having him for the entirety of however long their playoff run is just, I think, massive for them. Because again, there are reasons why they can succeed without him, and we can have a conversation in the summer about what happens. But for right now, they need him if they're going to reach their ceiling, which I believe, not that I would pick them to win the title, but I've said it before, I believe their ceiling is a championship team. I think they have been built to win, and they can win as presently constructed.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're built better than any other team, at least in the West,
yeah,
to beat Denver.
Agreed.
And I think that loss to the Nuggets a couple nights ago revealed how much they actually need him and how much they miss him. Like, as much as they played tremendous basketball for three quarters and were right there with Denver until the Nuggets pulled away late, the way that their offense wheezed to the finish line and kind of died on the vine, I think was illustrative of how much they miss his presence and the jolt of not just shot making, but downhill juice that he can bring them. And then also defensively, like, I know that is not where Karl Anthony Towns makes his bones, but you're looking at like the defensive strategy that the Wolves want to employ against Jokic. They want to have Rudy Gobert guarding Aaron Gordon and being that sort of roving helper. And whether it's providing double teams or whether it's just like coming with the late contest to make Jokic's life difficult while sticking, you know, in this case, it was Naz Reid who got the primary assignment on Jokic, or in some cases, it was Kyle Anderson. Cat's just way bigger than those dudes. And as like the kind of first line of defense against Nikola Jokic, I think he's the guy that you would prefer to have in that matchup than Naz Reid, even if you want to say that like Naz is a slightly better defender than Cat, which I'm not convinced of. Like, Naz defending in space, I don't think is all that much better. Like, he gets cooked on switches a lot.
I think he looks like he would be the better like defender in space because he's not as bulky or doesn't seem as thick, but I'm with you. I don't think it actually translates to him being any better in those situations.
Yeah, I think he is maybe like a little bit more agile. Mm-hmm. In terms of like just the way that he can swivel his hips and things like that. But like, again, it just comes down to the size thing, right? Like, Towns is like 3 inches taller. And in a matchup like that against Jokic, that can make a big difference. So that's specific to that matchup. But I do think it's illustrative of, yeah, they actually need this guy back. And hopefully, I mean, two games isn't a lot of time to get him back up to speed, but it's better than nothing. So,
yeah. And I think I'm really just interested to see what it looks like come the playoffs, because even though like last year Anthony Edwards had kind of taken the mantle, and I don't just mean, oh, they're like quote unquote best player, but even offensively had started to kind of take control of the offense, I think this was the year where it was much more clearly like set in stone. There wasn't an offensive hierarchy, and Ant was their guy. Like, Ant is the number one offensive option in Minnesota this year. And as we've discussed many times this season, Karl Anthony Towns had like really found a perfect role as this kind of like secondary, kind of like a 1B, but more of a secondary offensive option. And he was so good and efficient in it. And it was a role that we think suits him so perfectly, and one that I think he's better suited to thrive in when the postseason comes, when you think about some of the challenges he's had in the past in the postseason. So I'm glad he's back, because I'm really fascinated and interested to see how he can translate that to the postseason, because I think it is a role that's best suited for him that I think he can and will thrive in the postseason in this role, as opposed to maybe the role he had for this team in prior postseason trips.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope he hits the ground running, getting back, and that team can stay healthy and put their best foot forward in the playoffs. I think they deserve that after the season they've had and after all that franchise and that fan base has been put through. We haven't even talked about the ownership situation in Minnesota, which the latest reporting is that Glenn Taylor, of all people, is like the knight in shining armor here, who stepped in to prevent Mark Lurie and Alex Rodriguez from shedding payroll to get them under the luxury tax next season. Do we believe this?
Yes and no, because I do believe that Alex Rodriguez and Mark Lurie, to be honest, like most owners probably would, had plans to shed payroll going into next season, despite how good the Wolves are, how close to contention they are. I think to dodge that second apron, or at least come close to dodging that, I believe that part, that they probably did submit those plans. However, I don't necessarily trust that Glenn Taylor's the knight in shining armor that is coming in being like, oh, I can't allow that to happen, and for this contending team to be dismantled under my watch, and like for my baby to be destroyed like that. The way I see it is Glenn Taylor probably sees that as a very convenient part of his argument in keeping the Wolves, when really Glenn Taylor probably would have done the same thing anyway. That's kind of the way I see it. So it's like true, most likely true, in the sense that those are plans A-Rod and Lurie had. Not sure I buy that Glenn Taylor wouldn't have or won't have the same plans.
Honestly, I think that the way they perform in the playoffs will probably have a lot to say about this. Like, if they crash out in the first round, then I kind of think anything is on the table from a payroll slashing perspective. But if they make a deep run, like if they're in the conference finals giving Denver a hard-fought 6 or 7-game series, I think, or I would hope at least, that is justification enough for ownership loosening the purse strings and saying, whether it's Glenn Taylor or is the NBA still mediating this ownership situation? I don't entirely know where it's at in terms of approval for the sale or non-sale for Glenn Taylor taking it off the table, because Lurie and Rodriguez insisted that they met the criteria, like they got a funder in time to meet their deadline. Whoever is in charge, you would hope they would be willing to say, if this team can make it to like the conference finals, or even just, again, put its best foot forward in the playoffs and look like a team that is capable of contending for a championship, to say, actually, this is the right moment for this team to pay the luxury tax for the first time ever.
So apparently Glenn Taylor has actually paid the luxury tax before.
When?
So it was in one of the... I don't know if it was in The Athletic or ESPN, but one of the most recent reports into this whole saga actually did include the years, and I think it might have even been multiple times. But I will say, because you mentioned the status, Adam Silver actually said a couple days ago after the Board of Governors meeting, when he had his annual post-BOG meeting press conference, that the next step in this saga is that it will go to a mediator, like that was part of the contract, and that the league will have no hand in that and no say in it. Like he basically said, you know, the league doesn't belong in that part of the conflict. It'll be left to a mediator. So yeah, interesting times ahead for the Timberwolves, not just this spring in the playoffs, but at the very top of the franchise and the executive ranks in terms of who will be that overall top executive and their owner and governor, you know, by the time next season starts.
Okay, really quickly, because we got to get to these awards picks, and I do want to try and keep this episode reasonably tight. Did you have any thoughts on the Jrue Holiday extension in Boston? 4 years, $135 million, I think fully guaranteed, which, I mean, I'll just say congratulations to Jrue Holiday. Like, well, he's had a fantastic career, and he's been wonderful in Boston this year. I didn't expect him to get 4 years, that's for sure. But there's, you could say, like some mutual beneficence here, where obviously Holiday gets the guaranteed long-term money, and the Celtics can reduce their payroll for next season by, I think, like $7 million versus if Holiday had picked up his player option. So there's that trade-off there. I think there could be some pain on the back end of this deal, but the Celtics are one of the best regular season teams we've seen if we look at their underlying numbers. So obviously it was worthwhile for them to keep this team together for as long as they could, and this will help them do that.
Yeah, the Celtics are going to be in salary cap hell, especially with Tatum's extension coming, and there will be pain on the back end.
And a Derek White extension at some point too.
Yeah, and there will be pain on the back end of this deal, given Drew Holiday's age and the guaranteed term they gave him. But they're a juggernaut that will continue to contend going forward, so not going to argue too much about that. What I do want to just say is, I mean, you mentioned congratulations to Drew Holiday. Yes, congratulations, Drew Holiday, and another $135 million. But what I really just wanted to say is I freaking love Drew Holiday's career and career arc. Like, 15-year vet, NBA champion, Olympic gold medalist, who's still an integral piece and starter on not just a contender, but like the league's best team by a mile at 33 years old. A five-time, maybe soon to be six-time all-defensive guard, who's one of the most respected players in the league, this former Sportsmanship Award winner, but also the three-time Teammate of the Year Award winner, and three times in the last 4 years he won that award, which is voted on by the players. His two All-Star appearances came a decade apart. Like, and now two nine-figure extensions signed in his 30s. Both signed in his 30s, that will combine to be about to be worth about $235 million. Based on everything we know of watching Drew Holiday play basketball and everything we can glean from the way he is respected by his peers and coaches and executives around the league, like, an awesome dude, an awesome basketball player whose game doesn't necessarily lend itself to getting the kind of, like, you know, love or social media attention, or like whatever, as some of the glitzier, more offensively gifted stars in the league. But just full credit to Drew Holiday for the career he's had, for an awesome career arc, and yeah, well-deserved extension for one of the best defensive players of his generation.
Absolutely, and I will say, like, I do think his offensive skills are in decline, mm-hmm. and he's always been an offensive player who can run hot and cold, right? Like, for a guy who is, or has been over the last few years, a very good offensive player, he will have an inordinate number of offensive stinkers. So I think that's become more frequent in recent years, where he just doesn't have it offensively a little bit more often than he did even a couple of years ago. But in a scaled down role in Boston, he has done pretty much everything that's been asked of him, everything they've needed him to do, shooting 43% from deep this year and showing very little slippage at the defensive end. So possibly, like, in that environment where not as much is going to be asked of him offensively, the aging curve might be a little bit gentler on the decline for him. And that is obviously the hope in Boston. And, you know, even if that decline does happen, I think there's a long way for him to fall at the defensive end. And given how important he is to that scheme, I think, you know, it was important for them to get some kind of security in terms of locking him up. And again, I wouldn't have expected them to go to 4 years, but they did what they had to do, I guess, to get that commitment. So good stuff for Boston. Great stuff for Drew Holiday. Let's take the break there and we'll come back and we will very quickly rattle off regular season awards picks.
What's up, Pound the Rock listeners? Just a friendly reminder to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can also check out the Score's Fantasy Football Podcast with Justin Boone. And in case you haven't already, download the Score app, available on iPhone and Android. That's where you can find all of our feature content, as well as live scores, updates, and breaking news. And don't forget to check out the Score's YouTube page for an informative yet lighthearted dive into the sports world's trending topics. Now back to the show.
Okay, Cash. Awards picks, all NBA, all defensive. We are going to do this as fast as we possibly can and get out of here in our allotted 80 minutes or less. So let's just get right into it, man. MVP. of the 2023-24 NBA season. Drum roll. Who you got?
Yeah, very anticlimactic. No drum roll needed. It's Nikola Jokic again. There are guys that deserve love, just like every year. SGA, Doncic, Giannis, Anthony Edwards, maybe Jason Tatum. And for a while, I was leaning SGA earlier in the year. Obviously, would have said it was Embiid. But in the end, I don't even think it ended up being that close. Like, Jokic was the best player in the league again, was the best player on an NBA court most often this season. Once again, had the league's biggest on-off differential at plus 23.9 per 100 possessions. The next best MVP candidate, if you want to call him that, was Jalen Brunson at plus 14.5. The Nuggets on track to be the one seed again. Average roughly 27 points, 12 rebounds, 9 assists, a steal, and a block on 63% shooting from two, 36% from deep, 82% from the free throw line. Played 77 of the first 80 games at least at 35 minutes per game. Again, you know, there are arguments to be made for other guys from like second place down, but in the end, I don't think it was particularly close. Nikola Jokic should be an MVP for the third time in the last 4 years.
And I guess that's four in a row for you, right?
Yes.
If you were picking, that would be a fourth straight MVP for Nikola Jokic, which is insane.
Yeah.
Like, guys just don't do that. I do think there are points this season where you could have made a case for Shea. I think Luka has made a really strong push in these last few weeks, but I don't think there is anybody in the league who is in Jokic's stratosphere as an offensive orchestrator. He is the most unguardable player in the league. There, we've talked about it so many times. And you could say this about Luka as well, but I think it is doubly true of Jokic, where there just is no defensive answer for him whatsoever. And I think one of my favorite, maybe my single favorite stat of this entire season, and I put it in that piece that I wrote recently just about like the way that offense is evolving around the league. But the Denver Nuggets are fourth.
A feature that JJ Redick recommends you read, by the way.
Okay. I'm not trying to plug the piece. I just wanted to say this stat. The Nuggets are fourth in the NBA in rim frequency, despite being dead last in drives. Wow. That is what Nikola Jokic enables. Like, they get to the rim a ton, and they do not have to dribble the ball to the rim in order to do it, because he will draw defensive attention and that will open up cuts. And if you make a cut and Nikola Jokic has the ball, he will find you on that cut and you will get a ton of high value shots. And there's just nobody else in the league who could facilitate that in the way that he does. I also think like he's been very solid defensively for pretty much this entire season, which last year when I wound up making the case for Embiid over him at the end of the year, and obviously we can look back in hindsight and say they took their foot off the gas. It was deliberate. They were gearing up for the playoffs. That's all well and good. Embiid was like in a different stratosphere defensively to Jokic last year, which is why I ultimately wound up going in that direction. But he has not let go of the rope this year. I think he's been from start to finish very solid defensively for a team that has been in or around the top 10 in defensive efficiency pretty much from day one. So, yeah, to me, there wasn't really an argument as to who should win this award. I did want to say, because we can fill out, I guess, our ballots if we want, because we're going to do All-NBA anyway. And I think what's interesting about All-NBA this year, where it really just is the 15 best players, at least who have met the minimum games threshold, because it's positionless, we can just do this and that can be how we fill out our All-NBA first team, which we're going to do anyway. So I'll just say, I had a really hard time choosing between Luka and SGA at number two, but I think I would go Shea number two, despite what Luka has done over these last few weeks, which has been unbelievable. Like, make no mistake, you could make an argument that he's been the best player in the NBA over the last like month, maybe even 6 weeks, right? But that's not the whole season. That's a 6 week span where I think he has upped the intensity level on defense and been absolutely brilliant offensively. I think if we're taking this season as a whole, to me, I actually like, look, Luka's the better offensive player. There's no doubt about that. And I've said before, like, if these two teams were to meet in the playoffs, I would not be surprised at all if Luka was the best player in that series or if Dallas won that series, but I just don't think that's really what we're talking about. And I think the gap between them offensively is smaller than the gap between them defensively, where for most of the season, I think Luka has been a clearly below average defender, whereas Shea is a guy who I considered putting on one of my all defensive teams. Like, he's been that good at that end of the floor, on the ball, off the ball, has been, I think, like the best player I've ever seen at stealing entry passes, like from behind. And that has enabled all kinds of switching from the Thunder that they wouldn't be able to do otherwise, where like if he gets trapped on a big man, he's going to make it really difficult for you to enter the ball. And I just think he's been terrific at that end of the floor. That was the tiebreaker for me. But I'd be fine with those guys going in any order. I had Giannis fourth. And then, again, it came down to splitting hairs for me, but I did wind up going with Tatum with my last spot on the MVP ballot and my last spot on All-NBA first team. Between him and Jalen Brunson, I thought with the way Brunson's come on lately, it's gotten very close. But I still gave the nod to Tatum as clearly the best player on a 62 and counting win team. I think because it is very much like a collective effort, that it's not like in the past where maybe you would say best player on a historically great regular season team, he should be the MVP. But I also think that can obscure how good Tatum is and how much, I don't want to use the word sacrifice, but like how much he does to feed into the collective. Like, to me, one of the things I love most about the way that he plays is like he's a very willing screener, and the way that that can open things up for the team, for like Derek White in their two-man game, things like that. And also like what the value he brings defensively, I think, is just on another level from what Brunson can do. So that's my All-NBA first team and my MVP ballot.
I ended up going with Ant over Tatum.
Wow.
And as a very late, like I would have had Tatum fifth pretty much all year, and Brunson and Ant probably like neck and neck. I do think this last little stretch of the season where Ant did what he did with Cat out to keep the Wolves in that race for the number one seed was enough for me to be like, I'll give him fifth place in terms of who's been the most valuable to their team this season. But a very tight race between him, Tatum, and Brunson for that fifth spot on an MVP ballot or the last spot on an All-NBA first team. But In the end, I ended up going Ant just because of this last little stretch. And listen, I'm sure there are people listening being like, well, if you're going by this last little stretch, how is it not Brunson? But again, what Ant did to keep the Wolves in a race for the number one seed with Cat out, I think, was just the final nudge I needed to put him ever so slightly ahead of Tatum and Brunson.
Okay, so do you want to move on to another award, or should we just fill out the rest of our like top 15?
I'd say let's finish the awards first, and then let's fill out the rest of our All-NBA and All-Defensive at the end.
Okay, Defensive Player of the Year. Another anticlimactic one, right. I'm imagining.
Yeah, Rudy Gobert. Anchor of the NBA's best defense. And I know, listen, Jaden McDaniels deserves a lot of love for that defense too. And collectively, that team deserves a lot of love for being the best defensive team in the league. But Rudy Gobert is the anchor of the NBA's best defense. And not just the NBA's number one defense, but a defense where if you look at the gap in terms of points allowed per 100 possessions between them and second-ranked Boston, it's equivalent to the gap between Boston and 10th-ranked Houston. Consistent all the way through. I genuinely believe that Victor Wembanyama deserves consideration in this conversation, and I think especially in the second half of the season, the push he made. But if you're asking me who was the best and most valuable defensive player in the NBA this season from start to finish, I think it was Rudy Gobert.
Yeah, I really don't think there should be any doubt about that. Like, just the like by far the most important defender on, like we've talked about before, it's actually come down with Cat out, which again, shouts to Cat and his defensive improvements. I think he's been a sneakily important part of that defense when he's been healthy this year. I think when we talked about it last, they were like the 11th best defense relative to league average. So that's come down a few rungs since then, but still one of the better regular season defenses we've seen. And Gobert just anchors all of that. And like, you're never going to have a defense that good because of just one guy. It's very much a team effort in Minnesota. Nikhil Alexander-Walker has been elite. Jaden McDaniels, obviously elite. Ant Edwards, borderline elite. Kyle Anderson, borderline elite. Like, great defenders everywhere. But I think, for one thing, like, Gobert gives that defense its structure, and I think he also enables their perimeter defenders to get a little bit more aggressive, to take more liberties and more risks, because he is the best security blanket in the NBA. And as I've said a couple of times before, I think he has flashed a little bit more of his schematic versatility this year on account of the defensive infrastructure around him. Whereas like on those teams in Utah, he kind of had no choice but to be playing in like a deep drop the vast majority of the time because he didn't have the kind of insulation that you need in order to come out on the floor and do a bunch of different things in the way that Minnesota has him doing. Like he will get out and play up near the level of the screen. They play a lot of zone. Like they do different things with him where I think he's gotten to showcase some of the versatility that maybe we didn't see from him in the past. And I think whatever they've asked him to do, he's just been absolutely tremendous. So I had him as my defense player of the year. I had Anthony Davis second, Herb Jones third. I feel like we've talked enough about those guys that don't have to make the case for them again. But that was my top three. And then I wound up going with Bam fourth and Jalen Suggs fifth. So again, as with all NBA, because it's positionless, that is, you know, right there is like not only my defensive player of the year ballot, but also first team all defense for me. Suggs narrowly edged out Alex Caruso for that last spot. I did think it was important, as much as it is positionless. Like you could have gone with Wemby in that last spot, but I felt it was important to have one point of attack defender on there. And I went with Suggs over Caruso by the narrowest of margins.
Yeah, I had Wemby as my runner-up, Derek White, Herb Jones, and Anthony Davis.
Nice.
Yeah.
Where do we go next?
Well, I think this is just an easy way to segue to Rookie of the Year because my runner-up for Defensive Player of the Year, Victor Wembanyama, to me should be the unanimous Rookie of the Year. And I say that as someone who, up until about halfway through the year, would have given this award to Chet Holmgren. But I think Victor Wembanyama's second half and overall season ended up that special and that downright frightening for the rest of the league that he deserves this award. I mean, even just in terms of that Defensive Player of the Year conversation I was talking about, a Spurs team that was 22nd defensively this season, and if you take Wemby off the court, was much closer to last place, defended like a fourth-ranked defense with Victor Wembanyama on the floor. The guy averaged 4.9 stocks per game, 3.6 blocks. Overall, average going into the last season, last weekend of the regular season anyway, averaged 21.3 points, 10.6 rebounds, 3.8 assists, 1.3 steals, 3.6 blocks, while playing over 2,000 minutes as a rookie. In the end, I really don't think it was even close, despite how great Chet Holmgren was for a contending team. In the 51 years since all those stats, including blocks and steals, have been recorded, Wembanyama joins Bob Lanier, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Patrick Ewing, David Robinson, and Hakeem Olajuwon as the only guy to hit those statistical minimums across an entire season. And those Hall of Famers did it well into their careers and into their primes, all between the ages of 25 and 32. Victor Wembanyama did it as a 20-year-old rookie. He is Rookie of the Year. And again, all due respect to an awesome Chet Holmgren season, I don't think it was particularly close.
Yeah, and you know, really the most amazing thing about that is it's not like Chet had this big fall off, right? Like I do think he dipped a little bit from where he was at the start of the year, mainly offensively, I would say. Like defensively, I think he's held up for most of the year very well, but like it wasn't really about Chet falling off. It was just about Victor having a remarkable in-season come up. You mentioned kind of the defense and like how he transformed that Spurs defense when he was on the court. We see every game that he plays how spooked players are to challenge him. And when they do challenge him, he is blocking, again, 4.4 shots per 36 minutes. Absolutely obscene block rate. But one thing I want to spotlight is just the passing improvement. Like from start of the season to where he's at now as a passer is honestly one of the more impressive in-season leaps in that department that I can remember. Like he is just making out of double teams skip pass lasers to the corner that he wasn't even seeing at the start of the season that he's now making with regularity, hitting backdoor cutters, like over the top bounce passes, all different manner of ways to capitalize on the defensive attention that he's now garnering. And I think that's been one of the most impressive parts of this, is just how far he's come in such a short amount of time as a playmaker. So I had Chet ahead of him for a large chunk of the season. Then I think it was kind of neck and neck. And then over the last like 2 months, Wemby just exploded and left him in the dust. So Wemby rookie of the year, easy pick. Chet number two, Brandon Miller number three. But really after those two guys, it's like, who cares? Although, I mean, like, Brandon Miller had a nice season, you know? Amen Thompson had a really nice season. Brandon Pajemski, like, this is a really good rookie class.
Yeah.
And yet.
I'll make my first 2024-25 prediction, but that's a lie because I already said give me odds on Emmanuel Quickley for 2025 most improved player. But first somewhat bold prediction of the 2024-2025 season. A year from now, we'll be talking about Victor Wembanyama as an all-star, an all-NBAer, and the defensive player of the year.
Yeah, I mean, if you had just shifted the window where instead of being like the last 3 months of this season, it was the first 3 months of next season, that we'd already be saying that. He would be an all-star. He would be in the all-NBA conversation, probably wind up being an all-NBAer, and very possibly win defensive player of the year. So I don't think that's bold at all, actually, and I'm calling you out for making a not bold prediction.
Sorry. Okay, it's my first official prediction of the 2024.
Okay, all right, thank you. Okay, most improved player.
I ended up going with Tyrese Maxey, and I'll be honest, I don't even know how much we need to explain this, but like, I think he dipped a little as the season went on, and the Sixers obviously went through their slide without Embiid and weren't the same team they were earlier in the year, and he wasn't quite the same player he was, but I still think if you're going by like overall leap one season to the next and what was asked of him from one season to the next with James Harden gone, then with Embiid out of the lineup, I think Tyrese Maxey deserves this award with Scottie Barnes, Kobe White, Alperen Şengün, and one of Jonathan Kuminga or Jalen Williams taking that fifth spot. I mean, I think Jalen Williams is the better player, but if you just go by improvement season to season, I think you can argue Kuminga should get that fifth spot over Jalen Williams, but that's my ballot with Maxey, a clear winner.
Is Scottie Barnes eligible, though?
I thought most improved player is one of the ones that does not require a 65-game minimum. I thought that was only
I think it's sixth man that doesn't. I'm pretty sure most improved still does. Because if that doesn't, then not having Jalen Johnson on your ballot is malpractice, my friend.
That's
because the only reason that he wasn't on my ballot, and honestly, I think he would have had a strong case to win the award if he was eligible or is eligible, and maybe that's my mistake, but I didn't think that he was. And I agree with you that this, I am on the record of saying I don't think these games played minimums should be in effect for any of these awards, but especially for most improved, where it's like, if you've showed this improvement for 56 games, as Jalen Johnson has, then I don't think that's one of the awards where you could be like, but he only played 56 games. It's like, yeah, he played 56 games and very much showed that he had made a huge leap in that time frame, and I don't think it's like him playing an extra 15 or 20 games at the same level would have changed anything.
So you're correct. It is included in the awards that require has the 65-game minimum, and I just think that's so weird. Because, okay, like they have it for MVP, Defensive Player of the Year, All-NBA, and the All-Defensive Teams, I believe. And I figured they didn't have it for the other awards, but the only other award they have it for is Most Improved, which I find super weird. Like, we've already talked about how we don't necessarily believe in the minimum anyway, especially once the NBA put in the resting rules they did, where like they curbed that anyway. But still, they had this rule. But how do you say most improved player needs to have this games played minimum, but then like rookie of the year doesn't? So to say like this, whether someone was the best rookie or not, you don't have to play 65 games. But to say which player in the NBA improved the most, they need to play 65 games. Like, that just seems like a really weird decision. And I feel like if they were going to do this, they should have just done MVP, Defensive Player of the Year, All-NBA, All-Defense. Randomly picking most improved as the one other award you need to play 65 games just seems really strange to me.
Yeah, I agree. I don't really get that one. And if that minimum threshold was not in place, then Jalen Johnson would have been second on my ballot behind Tyrese Maxey, who I know you said we don't need to explain it, and I don't think we do either, but just because I've seen, we love to build our straw man cash as always, but like, because I have seen the sentiment out there that Maxey somehow is just like the same player that he was. Like, he's less efficient than he was last year. All he's doing is getting more opportunity or more on-ball reps. It's like, yeah, that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's easy to forget now because he's done it from the very beginning of this season. But coming into this year, we didn't know what Tyrese Maxey was going to look like as a point guard. Like, with James Harden gone and suddenly Maxey is the guy who has the ball in his hands initiating all of these possessions, there was no consensus about whether he was going to be able to scale up to that extent and perform the way that he has. And I think he has acquitted himself unbelievably well, including during the stretch when Embiid was out and when, yes, his numbers, his efficiency took a bit of a dip, as you would expect, because he has all the defensive attention on him. And I think he handled that in terms of like the way that he grew as a playmaker, as a guy who could deal with extra defensive pressure. I could not be more impressed by the season that he had. And I think, yeah, all right, he averaged 20 points a game last year. He did it on unbelievable efficiency. But that doesn't change the fact that he made huge and very important strides this year as we saw him step into the role of lead guard, which, again, I don't think it was by any means a foregone conclusion that he was going to be able to do that.
Agreed. And yeah, so if we went with a sensible ballot that did not include the 65-game minimum for this particular award, I'd have Maxey, Barnes, White, Johnson, Şengün. With the minimums, I'd go Maxey, White, Şengün, Kuminga, Jalen Williams.
So actually, yeah, I had that same top four. Maxey, Kobe White, Şengün, Kuminga. My fifth guy was Dante DiVincenzo.
Nice.
Who, like I've said before, what he's been able to do as a shooter, he's been a huge factor in keeping that offense humming when they've dealt with the injuries that they've dealt with. I think he's had a mammoth season. And behind them, I would have had Duncan Robinson, who I've mentioned before, like the way that he has sort of reshaped his game this year, doing way more stuff with the ball in his hands, better defensively, better playmaker, all this stuff. I thought that deserved recognition. And I always like to shout out the guys who make these unexpected mid-career leaps. And I thought he made maybe the most impressive one of those leaps this season. Also, Denny Avdija, very quietly, had a really impressive leap this season for obviously a terrible team. But I think the offensive strides he has made are real. And he's been a good defender for the last couple of years. But the way that he has developed offensively, I think, could be really important if he ever finds himself on a half-decent team. And Colin Sexton.
Nice. Who,
again, the Jazz have fallen into obscurity as they've tanked the last half of this season. But he's been awesome all year.
Yeah, and I wrote about the Jazz a couple of months ago, right before the deadline, and Colin Sexton's emergence was a big part of that, because if you believe in this kind of young Jazz core and them going forward with all the assets they've got, part of that is how flexible they are, and Colin Sexton's emergence is now a big part of that, because when you look at the player he has turned himself into and what he looked like this year, the guy's under contract for two more years at less than $19 million per year. If Colin Sexton can be what he was this year going forward, he doesn't even have to keep getting better. If he's just what he was this year going forward, that becomes one of the best bargain contracts in the league for a team that already has, you know, a couple good young pieces in place with more draft capital than basically anyone outside of Oklahoma City and maybe San Antonio. Like, lots to be encouraged by in Utah, despite them punting on the play-in chase for a second year in a row, and Colin Sexton, big part of that.
Okay, what do we have left here? Sixth man of the year.
You start us off for sixth man of the year. I feel like I've started us off for the first few. So you give me your sixth man of the year. I feel like we're going to be in agreement here, but give it to me.
I got Naz Reid.
Oh, nice. Okay, I had Malik Monk.
I had Monk for most of the season. I think just like how important he is to the Kings' identity in terms of the pace that he plays with, the way that he can work that dribble handoff game and pick and roll with Sabonis. He might be the most underrated passer in the entire league. Like, one of the most unpredictable drive and kick passers in the league, where he can get himself seemingly into some tight spots under the basket, collapse the defense, and find kick out angles that you just didn't think were there. And I think wrong foot the defense a lot of the time with where those kick out passes go. He's just able to create so much for them in terms of not only his downhill gravity, but the way that he can pass out of those situations. You know, I don't love just using assists as a barometer for playmaking quality, but I do think in this case, it's worth pointing out 7.1 assists per 36 minutes. I think that's like a good reflection of the way that he has not just been an important scorer off the bench for Sacramento, but also a really important playmaker. And if we're looking at similar kind of microwave scoring guards off of the bench, like Norman Powell, for example, huge differentiating factor between those two guys for me is that Monk is like 100 times better playmaker than Powell is. So I had him in this top spot for most of the year. He faded a bit, then he got injured. And I mean, you can tell me where you come down on this, Cash, with Nas and like the push that he's made at the end of the season. Philosophically, how do you feel about a sixth man of the year candidate cementing his case while playing as a starter?
I think it's, I had this same kind of internal debate while trying to decide on this award. And I do think it's interesting. Like, I think it helps him if you're, and if you end up asking, like, I don't know, who was the more valuable player to their team over the course of the season. But it, I don't know if it should help separate him from the pack in terms of who was the best reserve this season when he's been a starter. Like, it feels weird to use that against him because it speaks to his value to one of the best teams in basketball. But if the award is about being the best sixth man, then again, the counter to that could be, well, part of being, if you go by definition, part of being the sixth man would have to be that you would be next in line and have to be ready to step up if one of the first five goes down. So in that sense, hey, all the power to Naz Reid. In all honesty, I was splitting hairs between these two guys, and I'm happy for either one of them to win it. I ended up leaning Malik Monk, but completely understand you or anyone else going with Naz Reid. And in the end, don't think it should be used against him that he got pulled from the reserve corps to start when you know, a star player went down, and he acquitted himself very well.
Yeah, did a pretty damn good Karl-Anthony Towns impression while starting in his stead. I mean, he just, even before that, I think he was having a, like, he would have been second on my ballot even before this stint as a starter. So I think he's had a tremendous season as a reserve anyway. I mean, his skills as ostensibly a big man, I kind of like to think of him as a wing, despite, like, he plays like a big man on defense, but on offense, I think he's very much wingy in the way that he plays and his skill set. And I think it's very, very important to what the Wolves do. He was also my preseason pick, so maybe there's a little bit of bias here. But, you know, if that has to be the tiebreaker, then so be it. I'm sticking with Nas. Malik Monk, number two for me. Bogdan Bogdanovic, number three. And I think sixth man of the year is just a three-man ballot, right? So that's where it ends.
Yeah. Bobby Portis deserves some love, too.
Oh, lots of guys deserve some love, man. Like, if I were to keep going with this ballot, Trey Murphy III would have been probably next up for me. He's been starting a lot lately with Ingram on the shelf, but before that, I thought he was one of the most important reserves in the league. Got kind of behind the eight ball because he started the season on the shelf, but since coming back, he has really transformed that Pelicans team. So I thought he deserved some love. I don't think Jonathan Isaac played enough minutes to get serious consideration, but if he had, I would have loved to have made the case for him because I just think defense doesn't get enough of its due in this awards process at all. And I think it would have been cool to reward the guy who, to me, has been, because now that Caruso's starting, I don't think it's a competition, easily the best defensive reserve in all of basketball. So I thought he deserved some love. TJ McConnell, like the last month that he has had, I think has kind of butted his way into this conversation. Portis, you mentioned. Norm Powell, we mentioned. Lots of guys who I think have been really, really strong bench players for their teams this year.
Yeah, and real quick on Monk, like, you start thinking about his free agency. Like, he's 26 years old, like smack dab in the middle of, if not entering his prime, averaging 15 points and 5 assists off the bench, shooting 53% from two, 35% from deep on decent volume, 83% from the free throw line. You mentioned the drive and kick game. The way he just like fits in well to basically any team's plans from a modern offensive standpoint, like he's going to get quite the contract this summer, and good for him because he deserves it. And really interested to see what Malik Monk's career trajectory looks like, because, like, I know you can say this about a lot of guys that end up winning or are in the conversation for sixth man, but, like, I really do think with his skill set, his age, the way he could continue to improve, like, he could be a longtime starter for a good team in this league, whether it's in Sacramento or elsewhere. And I'm interested to see not just the contract he gets, but where he lands and if he ends up proving that to be the case.
Yeah, and just a shame, again, that he hasn't gotten a chance really to finish out this season in Sacramento, yeah. And they've wound up in the play-in, possibly as a result of that, plus Kevin Huerter's injury. Just a tough way to finish out what has otherwise been, you know, we've talked about it before, not, they haven't, like, exactly built on the energy of last season, but they have backed it up by playing for most of this year like a team that was in the hunt for a top six seed and a chance to get back into the playoffs for a second year in a row. And I, as you know, never fully believed in them, but I still think it sucks that they aren't really getting a chance to show that maybe they could have taken it a step further than they did last year when they bowed out in game 7 against the Warriors. So
100%.
Really too bad. Okay, I think our last one is Coach of the Year, right?
Yeah. I'll take this one to start. I feel like might disagree on this one, and I think I'm going to disagree with most people, but I'm going to disagree vehemently with most people, because in my opinion, the unanimous Coach of the Year, and it should not be a discussion, is Joe Mazzulla.
Okay.
Celtics are going to finish with 62-64 wins. Yep. They are not just the first overall seed. They're going into the final weekend as 6 games clear of any other team. They have, okay, whatever, the whole most efficient offense of all time, but they do, and they have the number one offense this season and the number two defense this season. They have a top 5 point differential all time, and the gap between their league-leading net rating and the second-ranked Thunder is the 4th largest gap ever between the league's top 2 teams. Even if you're more about rewarding overachieving coaches and teams as opposed to rewarding just pure team excellence when it comes to Coach of the Year, I still think that's an argument for Joe Mazzulla, because even if you thought the Celtics were the best team in the league, there is no way anyone can tell me that they thought the Celtics were going to be this much better than everyone else in the league and this historically dominant. So whether you're looking at team excellence and that's it, or finding the coach whose team maybe overachieved the most, I still think all signs point to Joe Mazzulla. And again, that doesn't mean I think he is the best coach in the NBA, but if you're asking me who ended up doing the best coaching job in 2023-2024, I think it's really hard to look at the results of this season and say it wasn't Joe Mazzulla.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree vehemently. I had Mazzulla second on my ballot, so I certainly agree with most of what you said, and we've talked on this pod, and I've written about his defensive ingenuity and how much I think that the Celtics offense can be kind of uninspired at times. People have obviously pointed to that throughout the season, like the crunch time woes. To me, that is more about a lack of passing juice on the team than it is about, like, any schematic deficiencies. But defense, I just love watching this team play defense, and I don't think that gets enough credit in terms of, like, X's and O's, like whether there is enough kind of creativity or imagination in the way that the Celtics play. I would point to what they do defensively and say that is where this coaching staff has poured all of its inventiveness. I think Mazzulla deserves a ton of credit for that. And I had him second. Again, I think he's done a wonderful job. I just think Mark Daigneault, to me, deserved the top spot for a Thunder team that I think I was one of the most optimistic Thunder prognosticators coming into the year. I saw big things for them this year. You know that I picked them to, you know, finish as a top 4 seed in the West, and that seemed kind of controversial at the time. But they have blown away even my rosy projections for what they could do this year. Now, obviously, Shea and the way that he continues to level up has had a lot to do with that. And Jalen Williams and Chet Holmgren, like, the players deserve the bulk of the credit. But I think Mark Daigneault, at both ends of the floor, has crafted a system that is so perfect for this personnel group. These sort of, like, the guard screening actions, the flat screens that continually disorient teams. And, like, Are they going to set the screen? Are they going to ghost the screen? The pace with which they run it defensively, the way that they can kind of pressure the ball and scramble out of it, force a ton of turnovers. We've talked about their deficiencies on the glass and how that is maybe tied to their defensive scheme, but the trade-off has obviously worked for them extremely well. And you're not in the locker room. You don't know like what these coaches are doing in terms of like interpersonal team building stuff and like how they're holding a group together when adversity hits and like certain things at practice where they're working with individual play. Like there's so much we don't see. In terms of what we can see, I think Dagnault is the clear winner here. With Mazzulla, you know, a clear number two for me, and then Chris Finch coming in at number three.
I had Dagnault clear second. I had Finch third. I mean, if you kept going, I probably would have gone Jamal Mosley, Willie Green, maybe Tibbs. But those, I think, were, pretty consensus top three across the board. At least they were for us. I'm assuming we're not doing it officially because you said the coach of the year was going to be the last one. But I will just say, piggybacking on what everything I said about the Celtics and why Joe Mazzulla, to me, should win coach of the year this year, Brad Stevens should win executive of the year.
Easily.
For what this team is and how they got there. When you consider that they got there by him trading Marcus Smart, Malcolm Brogdon, and Robert Williams for Kristaps Porzingis and Drew Holiday, made a gut-wrenching decision to trade a franchise icon in Smart and to break up a team that pretty much all they did was win 50-plus games and get to at least the conference finals every damn year. To make that decision to break up that team to trade Smart could not have been easy, was not easy. In the end, obviously paid off, at least from a regular season results, and these are all regular season awards. So everything I said about Joe Mazzulla carries over to the argument for Brad Stevens as executive of the year, and arguably more so when you consider the transactions actually made to put them in this position.
Yeah, I think he should definitely win that award. I would probably give second place in that voting to Leon Rose.
Yep.
But yeah, I think just the vision for Stevens in terms of the additions that he made this summer, I was like kind of lukewarm on the Porzingis trade until they went and got Drew Holiday. And then suddenly it felt like the puzzle pieces were all going to snap into place. And boy, have they. I mean, I just think there is a clarity of vision there in terms of what he wanted the team to be that has borne out in a way that I don't think any other front office can claim. But again, Leon Rose, kudos to him. Kudos to Tim Connelly, too, who might have finished last in these rankings after the way that last year went for the Timberwolves and is now a year late getting to reap the fruits of a sneakily good trade. But
on that note, part of that chaos in Minnesota at the top executive branch, when you think of ownership, governorship, whatever, also includes reporting now that Tim Connelly has an opt-out in his contract this summer. So again, if things do hit the fan in Minnesota with that ownership transition or non-transition and potential cost cutting, whatever happens, like, you know, I don't want to alarm Timberwolves fans given how well this year has gone and how well positioned they could be going forward. But yeah, things could get dicey very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you need to do anything to alarm Timberwolves. Like,
their existence is alarming.
Exactly. They live in a constant state of alarm because good things don't tend to happen to this franchise, and anytime good things seem like they're happening to this franchise, something bad inevitably comes to disrupt that forward momentum. So I think Wolves fans are probably on high alert as it is. I would hope that they are just trying to enjoy the end of what has been a truly tremendous season, and I just hope, like I said at the top, that they get to put their best foot forward in the playoffs and like deal with the rest of it later. You know, the cap crunch that's coming, the ownership situation, whatever happens with Connelly, that can wait. For now, let's just see this team get whole and have a really strong playoff run. I think that's all of them. I didn't really put any thought into clutch player of the year. So do we have to do that one?
You know what? I'm not going to lie to you. I completely forgot about that.
Okay, cool. So let's skip that one. It's probably DeMar DeRozan, or maybe it's Shea or Jokic or Steph, one of those guys. Those guys have all had great clutch seasons. I don't care. So what do you say we get out of here?
Yeah, we're not listing all NBA and all defense.
Oh, shit. Okay.
But let's literally list them. No argument. Let's list them. And we already have a consensus top seven for all NBA.
Yes. Okay.
So we had Jokic, SGA, Doncic, Giannis. I had Edwards, You had Tatum. We both had Brunson. Those are a consensus seven. We need eight more all NBA. You want to like go back and forth here? Just like,
sure.
Okay. Domantas Sabonis.
Didn't have him.
Interesting.
You had him second team?
I had him 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I did. I ended up having him second team.
Wow. Yeah. I love Sabonis. I really do. But I mean, I think he was actually my first cut. Like he was my 16th guy. So I don't have a problem with him being on. Him being second team is like, I don't know if I can get behind that. Like my second team was Jalen Brunson, Kawhi Leonard, KD, LeBron, and Ant. And I don't think I can make a case for Sabonis over any of those guys. So which of those guys that I just listed did you not have on your second team?
I ended up with Kawhi third team. And maybe
really? Just because I think that's recency bias, maybe.
Yeah, I was about to say maybe that's a little recency bias. But in the end, on my all NBA team as Sabonis ones. You mentioned LeBron and AD already. I had both of them second team. KD, you mentioned. Did you say yep. Steph?
I had Steph third team.
Okay, so did I. So what do we got here? Did Tyrese Haliburton end up making your...
He did. He wound up making my third team in spite of the underwhelming second half. He was so good in the first half and just... You know, I mean, powering the best offense in the league for a couple of months in terms of his own offense, the way that he created offense for others, the way that he did it while pushing the tempo, but without committing basically any turnovers. I, again, like we talk about players who sort of give their teams an identity, at least on the offensive end, I don't think any player really did that to the extent that Haliburton did for the first couple months of the season. And that was enough to give him one of my last spots on third team in spite of how it's kind of fallen apart for him in the last little while.
Okay, so you have two guys left to list. I have one guy. Who are your last two?
Devin Booker.
Okay.
Rudy Gobert.
Okay, you ended up going with Gobert.
So you had...
Booker was my final guy, and my three toughest cuts were Paolo Banchero, Tyrese Maxey, and Rudy Gobert.
Okay, so who did you have? You had Sabonis and I didn't, and I had Gobert. Is that the only
yes.
one?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, my third team is AD, Booker, Haliburton, Steph, and Gobert. Sabonis was my first cut. Then Maxey, Fox, Wemby, PG, Zion, Jaylen Brown, Jalen Williams, Pascal Siakam.
You had all those guys that had a Paolo Banchero?
Yeah, I'm That's like
insane.
Not.
That's insane.
Why is that insane?
All of those guys had a Paolo Banchero this year for all NBA. When you look at what he did.
What did he do? Like he had a really good year, but like all NBA?
Yes, all NBA this season.
Top 15 player in the league?
Cash. I didn't end up having him. I had him as a cut, but a tough cut based on the season he had. Yeah, I think he deserved that consideration more than even love Pascal Siakam, but he did not have a better year than Paolo Banchero this year.
I mean, statistically, he absolutely did. It's not even close between those guys.
I think for all NBA consideration this season, I think Paolo should have been considered ahead of a lot of those guys you listed.
Paolo, 54.8% true shooting. Pascal Siakam, over 60%.
Okay, we've also talked about this, though, when it comes to Paolo and like what he's got around him in Orlando and that overall offensive team and what he has to do. Like, yes, he has to grind it out there, and it's not always the most aesthetically pleasing, but like what he's done as the number one guy there for Orlando.
I'm not saying it's not impressive. I'm just saying he's not sniffing all NBA.
I just think in this particular case and with the team Orlando has and everything that has, I just think using true shooting percentage against Paolo Banchero in his all NBA argument is unfair.
Okay, and but like so you're comparing environments. Like Siakam was playing in an environment with very little spacing in Toronto, putting up comparable point and assist totals on much better efficiency to Paolo. I think Paolo has been slightly better than Pascal defensively this year.
For like an elite defensive team.
For an elite defensive team, but not it's not an elite defensive team because of Paolo Banchero. I don't think he's taken anything off the table there. But again, I think he's been slightly better than Siakam defensively and like actually quite a bit worse than him offensively.
I just think the season Paolo had for a Magic team that ends up in the hunt for the number two or three seed in the East Again, I didn't end up having him on. I got to say, I would have had him, what, like 17th, 18th? And again, out of the guys who played at least 65 games. But I just think the amount of names you listed off without mentioning his name was anti-Italian discrimination.
I mean, dude, I've given enough praise to Simone Fontecchio this season that you should know that that's not where this is coming from.
Fair enough. Right, should we list our all defensive teams?
Yeah. Okay. So all defense, I already laid out my first team. It was my defensive player of the year ballot. Gobert, Anthony Davis, Herb Jones, Bam Adebayo, Jalen Suggs. How about you?
Gobert, Wemby, Derek White, Herb Jones, Anthony Davis.
Okay. So let's see, because so far, we still haven't had any disagreements about who makes All-NBA in total. Because on my second team, I have Wemby, Caruso, Derek White, Drew Holiday, and Jared Allen. Wemby, for me, like, again, if we were just judging like the last 2 or 3 months of the season, he's easily a first-teamer. But I think early in the year, there were, like, sneakily, like, as much as he was still this, like, all-consuming force that spooked guys at the rim, deterred shots at the rim, block shots at the rim, all this stuff. I think there were times when he got a little block happy or like chasing blocks a little bit too much, including like 30 feet from the rim sometimes, giving up offensive rebounds as a result of that, and just like not fully having the positioning and drop coverage down pat. So I took that into account and just said, like, if I'm taking the season as a whole, I thought he was a very deserving second teamer, but didn't quite rise to the level of first team for me.
Sorry, did you say Jaden McDaniels?
I didn't. He was one of my tougher cuts, but
okay. Okay. So I'm just trying to think.
My second team, Wemby, Caruso, Drew Holiday, Jared Allen, Derek White.
Okay. So my second team was Bam, Jaden McDaniels, Jared Allen, Caruso, and Jalen Suggs.
Okay. So just, I think Drew and Jaden are the only disagreement we had.
Right.
You didn't have Drew on either of your two teams.
Right. Which was tough because, like I said, I mean, I went on that whole rant about how much I love Drew and his career arc and all that, and one of the best defensive players of this generation. I think if you were asking me who are the 10 best defensive players in basketball, I'd say Drew Holiday is still in that mix. Just when you're asking me to give you 10 all-defensive team members this season, I would have had him 11th.
Yeah, I just thought, like, he is so important to what Boston does defensively. Like, we talk about the kind of schematic ingenuity with the cross matching they do. None of that works without Drew Holiday and his ability to guard centers or power forwards or whoever they need him to guard. He can guard at the point of attack. He can guard in the post. He can do it on ball. He can do it off ball. He can do it as the center fielder in the middle of a zone. And like, there's been a lot of talk. Like, he's talked about it. Joe Mazzulla's talked about it, just about how they've empowered him to be basically the quarterback of that defense, to communicate their coverages, to audible on the fly. And I think I couldn't not put him on there, given all that, given everything that he does for a defense that I think they're second overall in defensive efficiency.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of their malleability, they might be the number one defense in the league, in my opinion. And I think so much of that owes to Drew Holiday. So I couldn't leave him off, and it was tough to cut Jaden McDaniels. It was honestly like, it was tough for me to cut Aaron Gordon. I don't think he's gotten enough love in this conversation this year. He's had a huge hand in that defense being the top 10 unit that it's been for most of this year. Same goes for KCP. Same goes for Brooke Lopez, who is still a wonderful rim protector. Kawhi Leonard had a terrific defensive season. SGA, as I mentioned, Isaac Okoro, Dylan Brooks, Chet Holmgren, those were the other guys I kind of had in consideration. So we did okay, Cash. I think we got that in a decent, not egregious amount of time. How do you feel about that combo?
Yeah, I think I'm satisfied with the quality and length of this episode, as I know our listeners will be.
Yeah, do we want to do a fan shout out before we get out of here? Or
real quick, I'll just give a fan shout out to someone who comments on our SoundCloud page, which, like, I didn't even know was a thing, but you can leave comments on SoundCloud, apparently.
Yeah, we don't get too many of those anymore.
Yeah, so shout out to someone who goes by the handle Kid Kills Me, but Kid is spelled with two D's, as in Jason Kid. And he comments on a lot of our tracks. And a few weeks ago when we kind of joked about DeAndre Ayton, you know, saying part of the reason he wasn't playing well during the year is because he didn't even have a bed to sleep on. He was just sleeping on an air mattress, and we clowned him. being like, you know, how are you a grown-ass man, let alone an NBA, multi-millionaire NBA athlete that allows that to happen? And Kid Kills Me commented on that one. Also, what kind of monster air mattress did he find that fit? LOL, what a clown. And also commented on our last episode, which was the longest ever, saying loved every minute of it. So I felt like, even though it's in a very non-traditional forum on SoundCloud, I had to give some love to Kid Kills Me.
I hope he loved every minute of this one, despite me ultimately putting Luka third on my MVP ballot behind Shea. I know that's a third rail type of subject. Mavs fans are getting mad online about... I mean, they're getting mad online about people having Jokic ahead of Luka. So I can only imagine how much Mr. Kid Kills Me is going to be fuming about me having Shea ahead of him. I'm sorry, but thank you so much for listening to these overly long episodes. And I hope you didn't tune out when you heard that.
And in fairness to you, I had the same top three. So
there you go. Okay, let's get out of here, Cash. This has gone on long enough, but it is our last episode of the regular season. So we had to close it out in style. When we're back next week, I think we'll probably come back if we're doing it again next Friday. The play-in will be wrapping up that night. Is that right?
Yeah.
So we'll be back when the play-in's wrapping up and we'll have some first-round matchups to look ahead to. But until then, enjoy this crazy last weekend of the regular season and the play-in round to follow. It's going to be all kinds of fun, and we're looking forward to getting back in the saddle for yet another postseason sprint. Until then, these were our awards picks. That was regular season number 6 of Pound the Rock. Thank you all for riding along. We'll talk to you soon. For Joseph Cacciaro, I'm Joe Wolfon. Pound the Rock.